Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Ever since Israel instituted a new approach to distributing aid in Gaza, people have been getting killed while trying to get food.
It is highly important that precedents are set for this model not to take hold.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, why lawyers are speaking out. Also, what the past week of fighting in the Middle East reveals about the dangerous patterns global conflicts seem to follow.
Plus, the environmentally friendly new building material replacing concrete.
The price of timber is high enough that it pays to grow a tree.
Yes, the return of wood.
Plus, opening up London's historic tunnels, bar service included.
30 meters below the streets of London, hearing the tube roar above you, hopefully a pretty decent drink.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today.
Iran State TV today reported the death of another Iranian nuclear scientist in an Israeli strike. More than a dozen Iranian scientists have been killed in war between Iran and Israel. Israel's ambassador to France told the Associated Press today that their deaths mean it will take years for Iran to rebuild its nuclear program. Also today, the International Atomic Energy Agency said there may be localized contamination and chemical hazards at two Iranian nuclear sites that the U.S. bombed over the weekend.
Countries around the world remain concerned that the conflict might affect their economies. Monica Toft is with the Center for Strategic Studies at Tufts University. She's now in Beijing, attending what's called the Summer Davos Forum.
A lot of the conversation is about what is happening in Iran and Israel and what it means for global politics. And of course, China gets 45% of its oil and natural gas from the Hormuz Straits. So when Iran started threatening to close that, a lot of chatter about that.
We'll hear more from Toft in the second half of our show today.
Meanwhile, in Gaza today, at least 44 Palestinians were killed while trying to get food aid near the central Gazan town of Deir al-Balah. That's according to witnesses and hospitals. People are getting killed nearly every day near food distribution sites since a controversial initiative was set up last month. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, backed by Israel and the U.S., uses private U.S. contractors to run those sites. And now 15 international legal organizations have written a letter to the GHF and the contractors warning they may be criminally liable for those attacks on civilians. Philip Grant runs the Geneva-based group Trial International, one of the signatories of the letter.
What we're arguing is that those in, especially in leadership positions within the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation or the private military contractors working in these distribution sites might be complicit in various war crimes. It's not only the shooting of already hundreds of civilians who gathered to receive aid around those distribution sites. But it's also the policy of the Israeli government to use starvation as a method of warfare and the enforced displacement of civilian population, especially from the north of the Gaza Strip down to the south where those distribution sites are located.
Can you walk me through exactly what is happening at these aid sites, where the violence is happening?
Well, you have military contractors, especially two U.S. military companies, who are assisting the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation in distributing the humanitarian aid only to a limited number of people. There are methods used to screen people getting into those distribution sites. There are scenes of mayhem because people are so desperate to receive the little food that is available. But apart from that, if you take a step back, there is a plan from the Israeli government to use these distribution sites as magnets for people who are in desperate need of support, and pushing them from their homes, especially in the north of the Gaza Strip, to descend to the south where these distribution sites are located. And this in itself is a war crime, forced displacement of civilian population. And if the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is supporting this scheme and lending material support there too, they are probably complicit in the war crime of displacement of population.
And so who do you think should be held responsible, and what would the legal charges be against them?
Well, the main culprit is the occupying power, but any person or any entity that is supporting these actions can be held liable under international law. There is a principle under international law that is called universal jurisdiction. If you are suspected of being party directly or as an accomplice to crimes under international law, you can be prosecuted anywhere in the world. That's what you see happening in dozens of cases against Syrian perpetrators, against Rwandan genociders, against a number of individuals. People with U.S. citizenship or other citizenships in the future that will travel to, let's say, Europe or other countries that exercise universal jurisdiction, if they were party to these crimes, could be held to account on criminal charges as long as it takes, as there are no statutes of limitations for these crimes. And we will make sure, at least in the NGO community, that any individual or companies that are knowingly violating these norms will be held to account. It is highly important that precedents are set for this model not to take hold and for militarized delivery of humanitarian aid not to happen in the future in any war context.
There are two American military contractors involved with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Is there any precedent for holding private military contractors responsible for crimes committed in conflict zones?
Yes, there are some precedents, including in the U.S., of private contractors, especially those who devised the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques in the war on terror, who've been held responsible for their role in particular in torture. So, yes, there are precedents, but not in a setting such as this one, where you have people who are supposed to be humanitarian actors participating in the commission of international crimes.
So as far as I can tell, there are people being killed on the road leading to these aid hubs because they're moving in ways that are not authorized by the Israeli military. And then there's also violence happening inside the GHF hubs themselves. Now, the GHF says no shootings have taken place in their hubs. They say all the violence has been outside on the road into these places. Does that make a difference where people are being killed?
Yes, to some extent, it depends where the killings take place. Only an independent and impartial investigations will allow to conclude whether Israeli defense forces were responsible for the killings or if the killings have taken place within the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's facilities. It can have a significant importance. But what we are saying is not necessarily for these killings as they happen today, that there is already liability. The simple fact of participating in the scheme is really the problem here. If the leadership of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation knew of the plan to displace people and willingly participated in that plan, it is already a complicity in war crime. You don't need to have to investigate every single killing to construe legal accountability. That could be additional crimes, of course, that are committed. But already at this stage, I believe, and we believe the 15 organizations that the leadership of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is already under strict legal liability for what has already taken place.
We are seeing headlines nearly every day of people being killed trying to get aid. There have been countless international organizations, including the UN, that have spoken out against what the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is doing. Now you're making this argument about legal liability. Do you think it will actually change anything when other statements like it have not?
Well, I think what will make a difference is at some point when cases are brought before judicial authorities. These crimes are not barred by statutes of limitation. Prosecutions or civil suits can be brought in the near and the distant future. I believe strongly there's a big sense of impunity at the moment. Remember that the former director of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation resigned before the operations were really underway because he could not guarantee that basic humanitarian principles would be respected, and also because he did not want to take part in the displacement of civilian population. So I do think some people should go and get legal counseling on whether they're taking part in this scheme might put them in legal jeopardy in the future.
Philip Grant runs the Geneva-based group Trial International.
The water guns have come out again in Barcelona, and it's not about kids playing in the heat. The water guns are being turned on tourists, often near major attractions, as part of a growing movement against tourism and the impact it's having on locals. Protesters have a simple message for tourists: go home and leave us in peace. From Barcelona, The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
I've lived in Barcelona for over 20 years, so I know how overwhelming the crowds of tourists can be. But for the latest protest, whose theme was bring your own water pistols, I decided to try to see things from the other side.
Arriving at the anti-mass tourism protest in Barcelona, dressed like a tourist.
As a caricature of a tourist, really. Hawaiian shirt, baseball hat, cargo shorts. I'm hoping locals will single me out and spray me with water. They've done it to tourists already. Today, just about all of the roughly 3,000 protesters carry water pistols, loaded water pistols. I catch up with a guy holding a protest sign in one hand and a tiny green squirt gun in the other.
Why are you guys against tourism?
Bueno, claro, ya una masificación turística, ¿no?
The over-tourism here is pushing up prices for locals, as 38-year-old hotel receptionist Miquel Belgrano. Our salaries, he says, can't keep up with skyrocketing housing and food prices. The protesters move slowly down a fashionable street lined with stores meant for tourists, and some tourists are out watching the spectacle, like Diane Laura Yohu, originally from Ivory Coast but living in London. She's come for the weekend with her sister.
Why are they complaining? Is it because they work too hard? I'm confused.
Yeah.
I was intrigued first, and then my sister just told me, Diane, this is against tourism, so don't say anything. Don't join, because we are tourists here. But I think a lot of people are tourists.
Yohu's right. Barcelona received nearly 16 million tourists last year. Fed-up residents have said it's too much. They successfully pressured City Hall to ban Airbnb and other short-term rental companies, but that doesn't take effect until 2028. And they say it's not enough. So in the meantime, the plan seems to be to make visitors uncomfortable. One apartment building downtown has posted a large orange sign on its front door. It reads, "Tourist rentals are prohibited here. Users who stay in them may be fined by the public administration." As I'm reading the sign, out come two elderly residents, Rosa Puig and Francesc Bosch.
El motiu és que no ten, no, hi ha un pis que està, que l'han dedicat.
"We put up the sign," says Puig, "because one owner is renting his flat to tourists, but he doesn't have a license for it."
No, de moment segueixen entrant, però em sembla que tenen el judici.
"The sign's not working," says Bosch. "The tourists keep coming, but the owner's going on trial this fall." The owner could face a big fine under current law, but the tourists cannot be sanctioned, the couple admits. It's a little white lie meant to dissuade, and people seem comfortable with it, including Mateo Bazar, a Spaniard from the Canary Islands off the coast of Morocco. He's passing by with friends and nods approvingly at the notice. The Canaries, he says, suffer from mass tourism too.
Porque en Lanzarote, a mí, te metes a buscar casa para la gente local.
"I moved here because on my island, Lanzarote," he says, "if you look for an apartment rental, there are maybe 5 or 10 offerings. But if you go on Airbnb, you'll find like 12,000. Bathar says cities across Spain lack coherent policies to control tourism. For example, on the one hand, Barcelona's phasing out private short-term lets, but the regional government just approved a new third runway at the city's international airport. It's left locals perplexed and angry, which helps explain the water pistols. And even though I stay dry at the latest protest, staff and tourists at one downtown youth hostel do not. In one video from a Spanish news agency, marchers try to tape over the hostel's entrance as guests rush back inside. One worker emerges with scissors to cut the tape. He gets squirted but manages to wrest a weapon from an assailant. He squirts back. The police stand by watching, as do crowds of bewildered tourists. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Still ahead, why concrete is out and timber is in, and why it's not as straightforward as it seems to calculate the emissions costs of those two building materials.
You are listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor here at The World. While I may not be a familiar voice, I've been deeply committed to our work here at The World for years, helping to share the exceptional global journalism you know and love. Since our launch in 1996, The World has weathered many storms, and we remain committed to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. But we are in unprecedented times, and never has the threat to public media been greater than right now because of the efforts to withdraw all federal funding. This puts greater pressure on our newsroom and our journalists. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We're powered by listeners like you. And right now, we need your help. Even if you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. We are in our spring fundraising drive, and a generous donor has offered a 2-to-1 match, tripling your impact between now and June 30th. That means if you donate $25, we receive $75. Your $100 equals to another $300. If you've given in the past, please consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small amount. Every gift, no matter how small, truly makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Stockholm, there's a neighborhood called Sickla, where people are moving into a new residential development. There are shops and schools, new apartment buildings, all made with wood instead of concrete. That matters because concrete is responsible for 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions. The trend of using wood instead of concrete is our topic today on The Big Fix, where we hear about efforts to deal with climate change. Robert Mendelson is a professor of forestry at the Yale School of the Environment. He says the wood used in construction projects like the one in Sickla, Sweden, is specially reinforced with lots of thin pieces of wood fused and glued together. They call it mass timber.
By combining these different layers, it can bear much greater weight.
Okay.
And so you can build multi-story structures with it.
And how much less carbon intensive is building with mass timber than concrete?
Well, there's always been life cycle analyses. Originally, they predicted you'd get 5 to 14 gigatons of carbon removed just because wood is less carbon intensive than making cement and steel. But one of the concerns that people have had is, well, but if we use all this wood, aren't we taking wood out of the forest?
Right.
So that's where our study came in. What we were trying to do is evaluate the effect on global timber markets by having this new demand. And what we were able to show is that the mass timber is going to increase the demand for wood. And so the prices of wood are going to go up and more land will be converted from alternative uses into timber. So what we're predicting is that with this huge increase in forest land, that you would actually get an additional 20 to 25 gigatons saved.
That's over an 80-year period. And I did.
Yes, that's over a century, yes.
And I did some very back-of-the-envelope calculations, because gigatons are hard to wrap your mind around, and that was something like the annual emissions of France?
Yes, about the size of a large country's annual emissions.
I imagine mass timber is still a bit of a niche product right now. How widespread is its use, and is it growing?
So it is definitely growing. And the only question is how large will it grow? I myself have laminated timber in a pier in front of my house instead of the steel that was there. Bit by bit, I'm guessing that you're going to see much more common use of it. But where you're seeing it mostly used right now is in Europe and the United States. Eventually, what we're also expecting is that you'll see contributions from other countries like Brazil and China. As the mass timber market grows in context.
Hmm. I want to get to the sustainability of growing wood for this purpose. You know, wood can be grown and farmed very sustainably, but I would imagine there are ways that it can be grown in a not sustainable way, like if you're clearing other types of land to monocrop, you know, timber. If demand got high enough, could this push into unsustainable forestry practices?
Well, it's possible it could. But it turns out today that the price of timber is high enough that it pays to grow a tree in order to harvest it. Almost all the trees now that are being used in the timber market have been grown for the timber market. And by expanding the timber market a little bit more, what we're doing is creating a market incentive to grow more trees.
How does the cost of building a mass timber building compare to building with traditional construction methods?
Well, they're close already, that which is why you're seeing examples of mass timber being produced around the world. My sense is that if we also added a subsidy, that would actually tip the balance and make mass timber much more attractive. And you would see a much quicker adoption of mass timber.
Robert Mendelson is a professor at the Yale School of the Environment.
It might be punishingly hot where you are this week, but it's probably hotter in Qatar. Temperatures in the capital Doha reached 112 degrees Fahrenheit today. Energy is cheap in Qatar, and people have basically become dependent on air conditioning there. When the world's Duri Buscarin visited Doha last summer, she found that even outdoor parks are kept artificially cool.
The first time I went to the Umm Al Saneem air-conditioned park, I showed up an hour before the AC turned on and almost gave myself heat stroke. But when I returned an hour later, that sweet, sweet cold air was ready to go, cascading through vents in the ground and from above in a lattice-covered walkway, paired with a background track of songbirds. Climate change is making summers hotter all over the world. But the Persian Gulf is heating twice as fast as the global average. So days like this are a preview of what the future looks like for all of us.
It kind of sounds crazy, having air conditioning in open space.
31-year-old engineering student Abu Sheikh Minon is running, so I join him for a bit. He's doing 5 laps around the park today, about 3 miles.
People can't be like indoors the whole time, right? So if you have some kind of air-conditioned outdoor spaces, it might encourage more people to come out. Even though it might seem like a waste of energy, it's still helping, you know, everyone to come outside and have fun.
Later in the day, laborers from a nearby construction site sit in the shade near the vents, finally unwrapping the thick cloth that they keep over their faces during work. Qatari grandfathers walk in groups, chatting, and a woman wearing a long black chador runs to pop music.
Beautiful scenery outdoors, well-kept, clean, well-maintenanced.
Barry Matthews, a defense contractor from Chicago, says it's his first time in Qatar, but he's already a fan of the park.
It's a beautiful thing. They need to contract this somewhere in the States, honestly.
Qatar is deeply reliant on air conditioning. In the summer, up to 75% of the country's entire energy consumption goes to cooling, according to Qatar Cool, a Doha-based utility. Only 12% of the country's electricity generation comes from solar power.
From a climate perspective, this is all very wasteful and troubling. But from a human dimension, you can see why it's happening.
Khalid Diab, spokesperson for Carbon Market Watch, says the Doha skyline is defined by tall glass skyscrapers and wide boulevards, designs that make cars and air conditioning a necessity. Diop says it can seem whimsical to cool an outdoor park, but colder countries use energy to heat the outdoors in the winter. Regardless of the source, the more energy we use, the more carbon emissions get pumped into the atmosphere. And as the climate heats up, the demand for AC gets even higher.
We may be seeing more and more of this. I mean, air conditioning in general has gone from being a luxury item to becoming more and more of a necessity.
After debuting outdoor cooling at the World Cup stadiums in 2022, Qatar expanded its network of air-conditioned parks, pedestrian streets, and outdoor cafes. Even the historic waterfront market, the Souq Waqif, has air conditioning now.
You know, I move out of my home at 8 a.m. It's still hot.
Nishad Safi is the executive director of the Arab Youth Climate Network. He says life in Doha revolves around the heat. People spend daytime hours inside until it's comfortable enough to emerge when the sun goes down. And in the summer, wealthier people go abroad to cooler climates.
So if there is no tech-based interventions like air cooling outside, it would be highly impossible to for people to even commute, meet, or even go out of their homes.
Safi says there are ways to do this sustainably, like increasing Qatar's share of renewable energy. But right now, a patch of AC in a big, hot city is like a breath of fresh air. For The World, I'm Dari Biskaran. Doha, Qatar.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The past week of war between Israel and Iran spiraled perilously close to what Middle East watchers have long feared, a wider regional war, with countries playing predictable roles.
You can see that from the comments from Benjamin Netanyahu that he felt that Israel had to act.
How do you think Iran will retaliate?
They will clearly use their missiles and drone force.
Iran warned that the gates of hell will open and retaliated with 100 drones and dozens of ballistic missiles.
Iran needed to save a little bit of face with their own people.
Even when a conflict seems to follow a predictable script, it still takes the lives of real people. The big question we wanted to ask today is why countries get into these cycles of violence. We asked Monica Toff to weigh in. She directs the Center for Strategic Studies at Tufts University in Massachusetts.
There's a couple of reasons. I mean, it's typically out of fear, right? So in this case, a war preemption, there's fear that one side was going to take an action against the other. And so the fear sort of spirals to the point where they fear or they feel as if diplomatic efforts and other kinds of efforts, perhaps some track two diplomacy, some background diplomacy is no longer to work. And so the only alternative that they feel is left is the use of force in order to demonstrate the resolve that please do not take another step because we are going to harm you. And we're going to harm you first because we're so fearful that you're going to harm us. So fear is often the driving force on this. It's not always, but a lot of times it's fear.
Seems to be the case here in the case of Iran. Israel argued the threat was urgent. That has been disputed, but that was Israel's rationale. How does urgency get us into trouble?
You know, humans are emotional. And in this case, you know, we don't want it to start with 12 days ago or 13 days ago. This has been going on for decades, right? Mm-hmm. Just the existence of Israel itself in the Arab Middle East. But then you had the theological revolution in Iran in 1979, and they committed themselves to denying the right of Israel to exist. So when you have that kind of relationship in a very tough neighborhood, the fear was pretty intense and emotions were already high. And also, you have to think about it. These are two states. You know, Israel is a Jewish race, Jewish nation in a sea of Arabs, predominantly a Sunni. And Iran is a Persian race, right, with a Shia. So on top of the tensions between these two states, they're also sort of minority states within this sea of Arab Sunni nations. So the intensity was already there. And then also you had a number of wars that were fought in the Arab Middle East already where Israel largely prevailed. But it's been getting tougher for Israel over the years, particularly as Iran was arming proxies to sort of go after Israel. And so that's the case in Lebanon. You can make the case in Syria, of course, with Hamas and then with the Houthis.
And then we hear all the time about proportionate response in fighting. It creates a kind of script. We do this to you, you do this to us, and then eventually we agree to say we're even and hopefully call it quits. I mean, take Iran's attack on the U.S. air base in Qatar. Iran told us it was coming. It came. The U.S. thanked them. Is this useful in some sophisticated way that I'm not getting?
It is. So one of the things you want to think about when you're thinking about war is there's multiple audiences, right? So you've not only got the regional actors that Iran and Israel need to convey that they still have strength. Critically, you have that domestic audience, right? So Marco, Iran has to convey to its population, it's built up over, you know, decades since the revolution, that it's going to protect the nation, it's going to protect its citizen, it's going to protect its borders. So Iran has to convey to its population at a certain point that it's back and it's that protector role of its territory and its citizenry. And then Israel, too, has to be able to say to its population, yes, we got harmed, but look what we did. Look at the damage we did. And by the way, we can continue to do it. And for Israel, it's going to be really difficult because if Iran attacks, it doesn't appear. Iran appears to have really desired to de-escalate this, made it very clear this was a limited tactical response. That if it were the case, then Israel would feel compelled, the statesmen in Israel, to respond again. And so you have that re-escalation of the conflict. And let's hope we don't get there.
I mean, you say audiences. I mean, it does feel very performative. But when we look at the results mm-hmm. of so-called proportionate responses, we often refer to body counts, how many soldiers or mm-hmm. civilians were killed. We get inured to these numbers. But when you stop and think about it, it's a horrific scorecard.
It's horrific. But from the Israeli perspective, what they would say is, we are nervous about a nuclear strike. And so from our perspective, I don't want to say it's worth it, but they're thinking down the road that if they can denude or degrade the capability of Iran to develop a nuclear weapon, that the costs are much lower now than if we wait. And then from the Iranian perspective, after they saw that the United States got involved, right, and is dropping these 30,000-pound bombs, right, that we could really wreak a lot more havoc on Iran. So yes, the states are willing to absorb some of these costs. But when you think about it, the strategic interaction between states and statesmen, they're thinking both in this particular moment of vulnerability, but then also in the future, what kind of cost are they going to have to pay down the road?
After the U.S. airstrikes on Iran's nuclear facilities over the weekend, we heard diplomats saying this is a huge escalation and it'll be very hard now to ratchet it down. A few days later, that's kind of hard to assess. What dynamics are you seeing?
You know, tactically, we have to give credit to the Trump administration. This worked at this moment in time. We have to wait. I mean, we're moving hour by hour, day by day here. But it really seriously rattled the Iranian regime. And the Khamenei, you know, the Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of Iran, is now in hiding. And there are discussions now about a secession crisis. And so for Iran, this really rattled them. I don't think that they expected. It was a huge escalation. The United States attacked another state. It was a violation of international law. For us, it was a preventive war. It wasn't a preemptive war. I think you could make the argument it was a preemptive war for Israel. But for the United States, it was a preventive war. And that's against the UN Charter. So nobody expected, or few people expected, the United States to do this. But once the United States did it, then Iran had to read the tea leaves at that point and say, okay, we're really hurting.
There's a lot of energy spent on saving face in these types of conflicts. I mean, what does that mean in this context, and why is that so important?
Well, diplomacy is always about the last 6 feet, right, Marco? So you want to be able to shake the hand of the other side and look them in the eye and recognize their dignity, right? It's really about recognizing the other side has some semblance of a cause for the fight. The critical next couple of steps is whether we can be magnanimous and allow for Iran to hold on to some sort of a victory narrative. But, you know, this is a strategic interaction. The question is how Iran responds and who, if it's the case that Khamenei is replaced with a moderate, or he could be replaced with somebody who's even more conservative and bellicose. But it appears that the politics, right, of the region has shifted. Israel did a lot of dirty work for the region by helping to degrade. We still don't know the degree of degradation of Iran's capability at this point. We have no sense of that until the IAEA gets in there and it does an evaluation of the destruction. And so we do want to save face here because there are humans on the other side. War is a very emotional thing. And hopefully as the victors, as the stronger side, we can allow that sense of dignity.
So President Trump has prided himself on his irreverence. Has it made a difference that one of the key actors here does not really follow the script we've been talking about?
Yeah, you know, other actors, leaders have done that as well. You know, it's called leaving it to chance, or madman theory of international politics or foreign policy. Mercurial, I think, is how I would describe it. I think it helped somewhat, you know, because with the element of surprise. Here's the problem, though. The United States now, in diplomatic terms, is probably not going to be trusted, right? So twice an argument was made that let's wait, right? Let's buy some time. And then twice he overturned that, and he actually basically lied about what was going to happen. So yes, I think it helped in this case, but it sets a dangerous precedent about whether the United States is a trustworthy opponent or a trustworthy interlocutor going down the road. So we're going to have to repair that. And hopefully this president, I suspect he's probably not. I agree with you. He's irreverent. He doesn't like processes. He thinks he knows how to do it. But I would hope that, you know, his team sits back and says, okay, boss, you know, we need to reassert diplomacy, because this is a guy who said, I don't want any more war. I want to pull back. I want to build the economy, right? So it's in his interest, if it's truly the case that he doesn't want to have another war in the Middle East, for him to reassert diplomacy as the route, so that we can get rid of the sanctions and then we can grow their economy, they can grow our economy, open up trade to a certain extent, and sort of close this chapter on the Middle East.
Monica Toff directs the Center for Strategic Studies at Tufts University.
And now, here are a few things you might have missed.
South Africa is getting a boost in its effort to overhaul its railroads, ports, and electric systems. The World Bank has given South Africa a $1.5 billion loan for those projects. In return, President Cyril Ramaphosa's government has pledged to tackle corruption and decades of poor management to get the country out of its economic rut.
The U.S. consulate in Hong Kong is warning that the city's government is suppressing U.S. Independence Day celebrations there. That's after a local Facebook page there reported that education authorities told teachers and students not to attend July 4th events hosted by the U.S. and to be mindful of the national security law. That's the law Beijing imposed on Hong Kong 5 years ago, which has been used to crack down on anti-government protests.
Meanwhile, in the city of Porto, Portugal, it's nothing but street parties. It's St. John's Eve, which the city celebrates with fireworks, grilled sardines, pungent flowers from leeks for good luck, and hitting people with hammers. They are small, colorful plastic hammers for fun, they say. One tourist told the AP, "At first I got frightened when someone hit me, but it has been so much fun because I think it kind of unites people when they are hitting strangers."
We refer you here to our reporting earlier this hour about Barcelona residents using water guns to try to get rid of tourists.
And that's a few things you might have missed.
Suppression of free speech is a hallmark of President Vladimir Putin's leadership in Russia. It's widely understood that speaking out against the war in Ukraine can get you targeted by the Kremlin. In the past 3 years, that's happened to theater directors and playwrights in Russia, leading to prison time. And yet, the show goes on. Russian theaters are still active, and plays by foreign playwrights are being staged. The World's Daniel Offman brings us the story of the most popular foreign playwright right now in Russia.
In the U.S., Martin McDonagh, the London-born Irish filmmaker, is known for his award-winning Hollywood movies. In 2022, The Banshees of Inisherin, McDonagh's most recent film starring Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson, was nominated for 9 Academy Awards.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you.
When you didn't do anything to me, I just don't like you no more.
You didn't like me yesterday.
But before rising onto the Hollywood scene, McDonagh was a successful playwright. In Russia, his plays are spectacularly popular. For the past 2 decades, they've been staged in cities and towns across the country hundreds of times. The man credited for popularizing McDonagh's plays in Russia is Sergei Fedotov, the founder and artistic director of the Umosta Theater in Perm, Russia. Here's Fedotov last year talking about McDonagh on Russian TV.
We are the theater in the world that put all the plays of McDonagh.
Fedotov says, "We're the only theater in the world that staged all of McDonagh's plays." Fedotov's theater has also hosted 4 Martin McDonagh theater festivals, and Fedotov has even claimed that McDonagh's plays have something quintessentially Russian about them. Just recently, a new translated collection of McDonough's 9 plays was published in Russia. Film critic Anton Dolin wrote the foreword to the new collection.
I really like this contradiction that McDonough have in everything he is doing. The contradiction of beauty of it. Sometimes it's beauty of language, sometimes it's beauty of landscape, beauty of music, and the ugliness of what's going on really, what people do to each other.
Most of McDonough's early plays take place in rural Ireland. Characters are often isolated, weighed down by their environment, their family, their village, unable to break away.
Being connected to the place and cursed with this connection, dreaming about something else and have no possibility to go there. Being obliged to this home hell with the people who are closest to you, but you still hate them and they hate you. This is very Russian thing.
Anton Khitrov, a Russian culture critic based in Germany, has a different explanation for McDonough's popularity in Russia. He says that in the Soviet Union, theater was censored by the state, so every production had to fit Soviet ideology. With the fall of the Soviet Union, Russian audiences were looking for something new.
The most important thing about it, that there were modern plays. Because in 1910s, all Russian theater was about Chekhov. They were like, okay, we don't have any Soviet censorship anymore. We don't have to stage plays about Lenin. Let's stage Chekhov and only Chekhov, and sometimes Shakespeare.
But Shakespeare and Chekhov no longer cut it. Russians had a thirst for contemporary voices, for a way to break with the past into a new era of theater in Russia.
I think Martin McDonagh is a playwright that they needed to create a totally not Soviet type of theater. It's a type of theater where you can see violence on stage, when you can hear cursing on stage.
McDonagh's plays are known to be raw, violent, often brutal, but still deeply human. His plays were a breath of fresh air in the mid-2000s, and they remain among the most popular plays in Russia today. And now, even as freedom of expression has devolved yet again, Khitrov explains that censorship in Russia today is unlike Soviet censorship.
Now in Russia, they allow something. You can work with McDonagh. That's okay. You can stage McDonagh. Like, if it's not political, if it's not about all these dangerous things, if it's not like pro-war, but it's something neutral, it's fine.
Khitrov says that cultural repression in Russia relies on unpredictability. Artists know there's a red line somewhere, but it's invisible. Cross it and you could go to jail. And yet, film critic Anton Dolin says foreign plays, like those written by Martin McDonagh, are less likely to ruffle the state's feathers, for the simple reason that they're perceived to be about someone else, not about Russians or Russia itself.
When you know that it comes from some other place, some other land, you have this distance. It's not so painful. You know that it's written by McDonagh. So it's Russia, but not totally. When you have this distance, you have more freedom. You have more freedom to laugh at the pain of the characters. When it's your own pain, it can become too painful.
That distance is perhaps one of the reasons McDonagh's plays are so popular in Russia. The themes feel oddly close to home. The brutality, the dark humor, and the pain cuts through. But still, it's not Russia. It's all happening somewhere else. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The London Underground subway system famously runs throughout the city, but there are other lesser-known tunnels below London, like something you might have seen in James Bond.
I'm in a stairwell below isolation.
You read me, Q.
I can hear you. I'm looking for you.
007 underground there in Skyfall, but now there's a plan to make these historical tunnels open to public visitors. Angus Murray leads a business venture to turn the tunnels into a tourist destination.
The tunnels were built as deep-level shelters between 1940 and 1942. This particular set of tunnels, known as the Kingsway Exchange Tunnels, were then expanded to be a deep-level telecommunications exchange from 1950 to 52. But it was held underneath the Government Secrecy Act until at least 1969. I don't think people were fully aware of the tunnels even up until recently, the last 3 or 4 years before we became involved, they certainly weren't aware of the size and scale of the tunnels.
Yeah, how far across London does this tunnel network spread?
So the total distance is about a mile, but the actual tunnels in total length are two long streets of about 400 metres and then four avenues of just under 100 metres.
These tunnels, I read, are 100 feet underground. So how do they sit in relation to the extensive underground transport system in London, whose stations were used as bomb shelters during the war? Are they deeper? Do they ever intersect?
So the concept that they originally built under is people walked from the street during this period of known as the London Blitz, when Nazi Germany was bombing London and other parts of England. And you walked into the tube line or down to the tube station, and then you walked again below that. So the tunnels are actually below the tube line in central London, and you were meant to descend down in that path.
Right. They were built during World War II as a bomb shelter, but I understand that they were not really used as a bomb shelter because the worst of German bombing was over. So what were they used for?
So the first real use of the tunnels was for the Special Operations Executive, which was a branch of MI6 started by Winston Churchill to do espionage and sabotage in continental Europe against Nazi Germany. And I guess from an historic point of view and an interest point of view, Ian Fleming was the naval liaison officer to the Special Operations Executive. So he would have been in these tunnels in early 1944 as they were coming up to the commencement of D-Day, which was on the 6th of June 1944. And of course, Ian Fleming went on to write James Bond.
So were the tunnels used during the Cold War at all?
So they were definitely used as a telecommunications exchange. And from an American perspective, the interest is the fact that the telecommunications that was occurring between the White House and the Kremlin in October 1962, being the Cuban Missile Crisis, that telecommunications had to come from the United States to the United Kingdom via a trunk line to the Kingsway Exchange tunnels, and then it went from the Kingsway Exchange tunnels on to Moscow. So that line was open and used during the Cold War, and particularly used during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Wow. Describe for us, Angus, what it's like to go inside these tunnels.
It's a bit daunting. I mean, if you think of going into a tunnel or any tube station or any train station, it tends to only be about 3.6 or 4 meters in diameter.
That's like 10 feet or so, I think, yeah.
These tunnels are as big as the larger ones are as big as the Eurostar tunnel, which is 7.6 meters in diameter. So you are in an extremely large space, as you said, 100 feet or 30-odd metres below the street level, with a tube above you, which you can clearly hear.
So I hear that there are plans for a spy museum and a bar down there in these tunnels once they open up. What can you imagine the vibe of the bar is going to be?
The bar was originally there for the post office British telecom workers because they couldn't go to the surface because the whole thing was secret, along with a canteen. As long as it's done up well, as people do today with bars, which are fantastic to visit, it's just that you're never going to go into a bar that happens to be 30 metres below the streets of London, 10 metres below the central line, hearing the tube roar above you. It's not deafening, but it's obvious above you. And you have a completely different experience inside a bar, let alone hopefully a pretty decent drink.
Yeah, total underground vibe, I guess. How did you hear the tunnels were actually for sale, Angus?
It had been put for sale by British Telecom back in 2008. There was actually an article in the New York Times with regard to that. But of course, 2008 was a pretty lousy time to sell anything, being the global financial crisis. So British Telecom weren't able to sell them during that period. We approached British Telecom with the proposal we had, which was certainly to restore the tunnels, also to build a memorial for the 43,000 British civilians that died during the London Blitz, and the story of that time. And British Telecom felt that it was an adequate use for that asset and felt compelled to sell it to us.
One would hope visiting this underground tunnel network will be more of a bucket list thing to tick off for visitors. What do you hope the public will take away from coming to these tunnels?
London is the most visited Western city for international tourists. It's a hub and it's an access for Europe. Many Americans use it that way. I think that London is about its history. If we can bring that history alive, not only from the raw devastation of the London Blitz and the Second World War, but then into the literary world of James Bond, Q Branch, this would have been what Ian Fleming was describing as Q Branch. We can add in some other cultural and arts along with the deepest license bar. I think it's a wonderful addition to a great city. And each city is really competing against each other to get more and more tourists. It would be wonderful for people to walk away and understand the impact of the London Blitz. If you've ever had a chance to go to the September 11 Memorial in New York, which is a wonderful project, it clearly is enormously emotionally evocative as people read out when they first heard about the towers being attacked. And although we won't be the same story, it will certainly be about the children and the men and women that died during that period of time, which was nearly an 8-month period where 43,000 people died.
That's Angus Murray. He's leading a venture to open a set of little-known London tunnels to the public. Target date, 2028.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Henry Becton, Richard Gingras, Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Rima Heider and Camilo Villa. And the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.